to our second hour of World Crisis Radio. And, of course, in this past week, there's been news on the Obama birth certificate front. And as I understand it, a federal judge has thrown out a suit brought by the bungling Orly Cates and has given her a warning about filing more suits of this sort. I think this bears more on the ineptitude and bungling capacity of Orly Cates than it does on the merits. But to get a legal evaluation of this, let's go right to the source. Let's go to the founder of this entire movement, the Alpha Birther, as he's been called in the Philadelphia press. And that would be Phil Berger, Philadelphia, who's now shepherding three Obama birth certificate cases through the federal courts. Phil, welcome.
Welcome. My pleasure to be on your show. And as I've stated, this is now, I guess, my 14th month pursuing this. And as you know, through our website, obamacrimes.com, obamacrimes.com, we have stayed straight and narrow. We're looking for the truth. We're hopefully going to do it through the court system. If not, we're trying to get the public with us on this. Unfortunately, you know, I hate to speak about another attorney, but you just brought the topic up, and the judge in this case just dismissed the case. It was brought by Orly Cates. She has really been, in my opinion, I said it before, and now it's just coming forth that she is really out there to hurt the movement. I don't know what her intentions are. I don't know who's paying her. I don't think she's just that inept. I'm not sure what's going on, but the Georgia federal judge in Georgia dismissed her case on behalf of another military person who was trying to say that they're a conscientious objector because they're not sure of the status of the president. Well, once you put conscientious objector down, the military will immediately change your status anyhow because they don't want someone in a war zone, which could end up affecting the men and women there with the intentions to fight the battle. That's where you get into situations of friendly fire and other crisis situations. So that's why the judge really chastised Ms. Cates for this is the second suit she just filed. And on this particular suit, it was filed first in Texas, who threw it out. Then it got to Georgia because that was the send-off point, I believe, and it came to the same judge that threw a case out of hers like a few weeks or a month ago. And I'm not sure if you've read it, and again, I don't like to come up with bad stuff, but I'm trying to get people in line and widen the horizons on this, get more and more people involved. But now the Orly Cates has a case out in California, which there's just been a fight because Gary Krepp, K-R-E-E-P, has taken over for two of the plaintiffs in that case. But now it comes out that at a hearing, which was going to be last week, two potential witnesses for Orly Cates have publicly come out and stated that they couldn't deal with her anymore because she has actually asked them to lie under oath in that case. And there's articles about that. And I'm glad these people are speaking up. One is Larry Sinclair. Another one is Lucas Smith. And we can't have that kind of thing here. I don't know the intentions of her, but I know people have filed complaints against her to the state bar in California. But more important, that's why people should stay away from her and should stay on our thing, Obama Crimes. As you mentioned, we have three cases pending. One, we're getting closer on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia for October 26th. That's the argument on the case that I originally filed before the Democratic National Convention last year, and the judge dismissed my case on standing. And as stated before, if the judge basically said, I don't have standing, Webster doesn't have standing, none of your listeners have standing, no one has standing, and perhaps in the future the Congress can decide who should have standing to attack the Constitution. It's just wrong. It's blatantly wrong. Under the 10th Amendment, everything reverts back to we the people if it's not conferred elsewhere on the Constitution. So I believe we have a solid case there. I'm not sure if the Third Circuit's got guts enough to deal with this. We're dealing with some, you know, there are heavy issues here. It's a sad state of affairs, and but the thing is, if you think about it, and if all your listeners will just think for one moment, the reason we're doing this is because Obama has not been honest to the electorate in this country. He's not been honest to the people of this country. He will not divulge any information about himself. The other day was Constitution Day. the 222nd anniversary of the signing of the U.S. Constitution. And I basically said that it's shame on Obama on the anniversary for not living up to the Constitution. The Constitution requirement for president is only three requirements. One, be 35 years of age. Number two, live in this country for 14 years. And number three, be a natural-born citizen, which is our claim that Obama is not. But also it's interesting, someone raised the question to me a few weeks ago, how do we really know his birth date is August 4th, 1961? Because we don't have any documentation on anything about this person.
Hey, right. You've got to be 35 years old to be president, right?
That's right.
And we don't know.
We really don't know. I mean, because nothing has, I mean, think about it. Nothing has been put forth except that phony document which they put on their website in June of 2008, which they keep referring to as a birth certificate, but it's not a birth certificate. But so I have that one case on standing. We have the case with Hollister, the retired Air Force colonel, which is on appeal to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. But the other case, and we checked with the judge's office, they're aware that we're waiting for a hearing, and I think I put the judge in a very precarious position. This is the case which was filed originally under seal, and when it was filed under seal, it was not because it was anything special with Obama, but all that type cases are put under seal. They're usually Medicaid or Medicare fraud. And what happens is you don't notify the party, you notify the Justice Department, the Attorney General's office, and they look at it and they decide either to handle the case themselves, give it to the person who's brought forth the case, which is called the relator, in this case me, or three, dismiss the case. Well, very few of those cases are dismissed, but they put us in the dismissal case, and I don't think it's right because I'm alleging that Barack Obama, when he came back from Indonesia, never went through immigration since he became a natural born because of the adoption in Indonesia. When he came back, if he didn't go through immigration, he's an illegal alien. Not only can he not be president, but his term as a U.S. senator was fraudulent. Therefore, all money and benefit that went to him during the U.S. Senate race, totaling over $1 million, should go back to the U.S. Treasury. I think it's a very valid point. So after the judge dismissed our case, we filed a motion for reconsideration, and we dug further. We found a statute called conflict of interest. And if there ever was a conflict of interest, it's Eric Holder. He is the attorney general. Now, his underlings say, well, he has nothing to do with the case. Well, if the case is assigned to the U.S. Attorney General's office and the Department of Justice, it does fall under Holder.
Of course.
And there's a conflict of interest because, number one, he was on Obama's campaign committee. Number two, he was one of three individuals on the committee to select the vice president, which selected Biden. Number three, he was appointed and confirmed as the attorney general, which is the highest law enforcement officer in the country, who also gives advice to the president. So if that's not a conflict of interest, so that's what we raised there. And then we asked the court to make a decision on that. And I think I have the court cornered because whereas the judge said they weren't allowed to discuss the issue on the Qui Tam or False Claim Act because of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, I've now raised this other issue, which I think comes secondary or actually primary on this. And we ask that either the Attorney General let me proceed with the case or appoint a special prosecutor. And now, interesting, if everyone's been watching, in the past month, he appointed a special prosecutor to look in action to the CIA during the Bush administration. So if he could do that because they say he's Mr. Independent, I sort of cornered, I believe, the Attorney General that if he doesn't do it, it's just that direct evidence that he does not want to prosecute his boss, the President of the United States. So we're waiting for the judge to come up with a hearing. When we do, I'm going to let you know, and so your listeners hopefully will pack the courtroom in Washington, D.C.
But in the meantime, it's October 26th in Philadelphia. And
that's correct.
You can tell us what time of day when you find that out, okay?
I sure will. And people, please go to ObamaCrimes.com, spread it to other people, and if you can make a contribution, this is now our 14th month of proceeding.
Wonderful. More power to you, Phil. Hang in there, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Phil Berg, deserving of everybody's support. Go to ObamaCrimes.com. Give him a contribution. This is the leading front. You can see this Oli Tates, completely incompetent, flailing and indeed veering into these areas of malpractice. Therefore, stick with Berg, and that's ObamaCrimes.com. Don't get demoralized. The failures of the Oli Tates cases have nothing to do with the merits, but simply the ineptitude and the bungling of Oli Tates. Now, let's look at the Polish missile crisis, right? The big news this past week is that Obama has decided not to install the Bush version of a missile shield in Poland. That was going to be 10 interceptors in silos in northern Poland, backed up by a radar in the Czech Republic and other sensors. The other sensors would have reached rather deep into the Baltic states, according to quite a few reports. Now, Obama says he's not going to do that. He is going to call that off, and he's going to go with the Aegis missile system later on. Now, this is precisely what we have been predicting over the past 18 months. Remember, the goal of Obama is that the United States steps back from direct confrontation with enemies, but rather employs puppet states and indirect means to try to play one enemy state against the other, the classical essence of imperialism, the so-called buck passing, right? Play Russia against China, play Iran against China, play Iran against Russia, play African states against China, and so forth. Play India against Russia and China, if possible. This is the new look. Now, therefore, play Georgia against Russia. That's another version of this. The problem is when you're dealing with something as small as Georgia, it's pretty clear who's behind it. So the U.S. is now crawling all over Georgia. This is not a not a good thing. But the novelty now is that instead of having a limited number, so-called 10 missiles, and nobody knows what kind of missiles they would be, those could be first-strike missiles. There's no inspection of those missiles. So those could be pointed directly at Moscow. The Russian objection was that these so-called anti-missile missiles, ABM missiles, or missile shield operations, this was a thinly disguised version of a first-strike strategy, meaning the U.S. would pull a surprise sneak attack on Russia, and then the Russian retaliatory second strike would be suppressed by, with the help of these 10 missiles. And of course, who's going to guarantee that they were 10? The new version now depends on the Aegis cruisers and Aegis destroyers of the Navy. And instead of being 10, it's going to be dozens, and it might get up to hundreds. These would be, since the cover story offered by the U.S. is that it's directed against Iran. It's Iran. Now, they say, oh, the Iranian ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, are not going forward on the fast track. The Iranians are going more into short-range ballistic missiles, medium-range ballistic missiles, maybe even intermediate-range ballistic missiles. So, therefore, you've got to defend against that. You can look at the 1,200-mile range of the Iranian Sajil-2 missile, S-A-J-I-L. The Sajil-2 with a 1,200-mile range can reach into Ukraine, into Moldova, into Romania, Bulgaria, Greece, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, into India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, China, Kazakhstan, and deep into Russia, almost to Moscow. All of southern Russia is in the range of this missile. So they say, no, we're not going to put these things into Poland. We're going to put Aegis cruisers in the eastern Mediterranean. Who knows if they won't put them in the Black Sea, because that would make sense, too. Caspian Sea, you can't get to, at least under any known system. But these are waterborne vectors for these anti-missile missiles. It's going to be the standard missile Mark III, short-range interceptor missiles. It looks like the Poles get a Patriot missile battalion as a short-term consolation prize. Now, the problem with this is the following. The numbers are completely open-ended. So it's not just 10, it's gone to dozens. So it's far more. They don't seem to involve Russia directly at this point. But here's the idea. The current deployment, the thing that Obama has announced, is Aegis missiles on cruisers, destroyers, and other ships that will be complete by 2011. But then there's going to be a second generation of Aegis-directed anti-missile missiles deployed by 2015, and then a third generation by 2018. And those could be extremely capable. Those could, and are intended to be, quite frankly, designed to protect both Europe and the United States against short-range, intermediate-range IRBMs, already quite robust, and eventually against intercontinental ballistic missiles by 2018. So that's the third phase. Now, the principal Russian objection is voiced by Major General Vladimir Dvorkin. He is the head of the distinguished Russian military man, former chief of the Research Institute of the Red Army for Nuclear Strategy. He says that the reconfigured U.S. system could still be directed against Russia. And I quote Major General Vladimir Dvorkin, who says, quote, "Everything depends on the scale of such a system," he says to Interfax. "If it comprises a multitude of facilities, including a space echelon, it may threaten the Russian potential for nuclear deterrence." Now, other than that, the Russian response is positive. Medvedev says this creates good conditions for working with the United States. Medvedev takes note of Obama's responsible attitude. "We will have to conduct substantial expert consultations on this, and we will do so. We will work together to develop effective measures against the risk of missile proliferation, measures that take into account the interests and concerns of all sides and include equal security for all countries in Europe." Now, today, Putin also says that this is a brave measure by Obama, but Putin also says, now, why don't you drop your economic warfare measures, which include the so-called COCOM list, in other words, the effective prolongation of the technically defunct but actually quite robust, quite live COCOM list, which means that high-tech equipment cannot be exported, or it's almost impossible, prohibitively difficult to get high-tech equipment, modern computers, things like this, exported into Russia. So Putin says, drop that. The idea is this is appeasement, but why? The goal, of course, is to turn Russia against Iran, as we will show you in the next segment.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley in Washington. Remember, go to tarpley.net, tarpley.net, and find the entire 1992 biography of Bush the Elder for free. Download it, read it, learn the lessons of it, and also you can find ways to buy the more recent books. Go to tarpley.net. That website is in the process of being upgraded. That will take a while, but in the meantime, you can certainly get all of these things there. You'll also find a good essay from Against Oligarchy, which is the real story of the crash of 1929, British bankruptcy of 1931, and U.S. banking crisis of 1932-33. What you need to know to follow what's going on. That's there for free. Enjoy it. Learn from it. The decision now by the Obama-Gates-Clinton administration to change the anti-missile missile deployments in Eastern Europe from land-based in Poland to Aegis sea-based, but then possibly land-based, this could get into the hundreds. And as the Russian expert says, it could have a space component. What is the goal? It is, of course, to push Russia forward into a conflict situation with Iran. We saw this happening from the Iranian side, the Rafsanjani Mousavi coup faction in Tehran some weeks back was chanting death to Russia, death to China, whereas Ahmadinejad went with the tried and true death to America. But it's the death to Russia, death to China. That's the CIA faction. That's what they were proclaiming with that. That doesn't seem to be going anywhere. It looks like Ahmadinejad is consolidating, much to the chagrin of the Anglo-Americans. That color revolution didn't work. The authoritarian apparatus, the Iranian state, is lashing out against these subversive forces, because that's what they are. The forces of color revolution, people power coup, and U.S.-British imperialism, they're losing out. But now they're also trying from the other side, pushing Russia forward. You can see in all the news accounts, it's a bid to get Russia to take the point against Iran in terms of economic sanctions and ultimately of some kind of possible military clash down the road. Who knows how much Brzezinski thinks he can get. Lavrov, of course, the Russian foreign minister, knows this. This is not a secret. Lavrov, in the wake of this announcement by Obama yesterday by now, said, Russia still do not think that there should be any additional economic sanctions against Iran. There's also going to be a START treaty negotiation. It looks like it's a package. The START, strategic arm reduction talks, negotiated in the Reagan administration, ultimately, Reagan during the 80s. This is about to run out, so it's got to be renewed. Russia and the U.S. want it to be renewed. There will be a deal made now in Russia in December for the START treaty. So these go together. However, look also now at this guy, Faux Rasmussen. It's not F-A-U-X, but F-O-G-H, F-A-U-X Rasmussen, says that it's now time to merge the anti-ballistic missile capabilities of the U.S., NATO, and the Russian Federation. Oh, my gosh. An alliance, practically. They're suddenly forgetting all about Georgia and Saakashvili's concerns, and they're forgetting about the kleptocrats of Kiev. They're also not paying too much attention to the Kaczynski twins in Poland, and they're not paying too much attention to the right-wingers in Prague who wanted this radar. But what is this? U.S., NATO, and Russian Federation against Iran? And where does that leave China, I wonder, if you have U.S., NATO, Russian Federation all merging? I think this is Chamberlain. Remember, what was Chamberlain? What was appeasement? What is appeasement? Appeasement is not a peace policy. Appeasement is the idea that you can con what is, after all, your enemy into fighting another enemy. With Chamberlain in the 1930s, it was play Hitler against Stalin and destroy both of them. Today, it's got to be play Iran against Russia and weaken or destroy both, or play Russia against China, play Russia against Iran, Iran against Russia, you know the drill. So that is what is going on, and my opinion has always been it won't work. So therefore, don't be surprised if this does not succeed, but it could work, and that's the danger. So don't be duped. Don't let anybody be duped by Obama. Remember, as we've heard in the Congress, he lies. Yes, indeed, he does lie. Dissembling, deception, fakery, manipulation, duping people is the essence, the nerve and fist of everything that Obama does, and that is what he is doing right now. There will be talks between the U.S. and Iran coming up. This starts on October 1st, right? And all the talk about attack, I think, is the Israeli attack and all the rest of this. This is now blackmail, to be sure, but it's in the process of making a deal or attempting to make a deal. Who knows what it's going to be? October 1st, it starts. It's the permanent five of the United Nations plus one. That would be U.S., Britain, France, China, Russia. There's your perm five, plus Germany, BRD, with Iran. So it's going to be six against one, in effect. But, of course, it won't be six against one because China and Russia are not part of that lockstep. And I don't believe Russia is going to be dupable in that regard. Now, moving on quickly, that's your Polish missile crisis update. Let's look for a second at something new has occurred, and I think it's actually good. The House of Representatives has now passed a bill that would shift student loans out of the private sector and into the form of government loans. That is to say, the government being its own bank for purposes that it wishes to promote based on votes in Congress. This is exemplary. This is a good thing. Don't let those reactionaries say, oh, this is another big government takeover. Baloney. What it has been up to now is a costly program where the U.S. government pays subsidies to private lenders to attain the result of getting those lenders to make student loans. Well, the problem was, last year in the credit crunch, they stopped. Many of them simply failed to do so. They were not reliable. A lot of people had their college education disrupted, interrupted, sabotaged, torpedoed by the fact that these greedy private lenders were not able to make the subsidized and guaranteed student loans under Sallie Mae and related programs. Therefore, what is the point of paying a private banker to do something and paying him a lot, and he carts off huge profits, bonuses, rake-offs, and all the rest, when you might as well do it directly yourself? In other words, save some money. The government should be its own bank. And then we can say these were zombie lenders in the same way that Goldman and Morgan and Citi and Bank of America and Wells Fargo and Mellon, those are all zombie banks. Why are you subsidizing them with bailouts to get you then to get them to lend you money? Same thing with the student loan area. Don't let zombie lenders who are greedy for subsidies and give lousy high interest rates to students, why subsidize them? Do it yourself. If this method were applied to the Federal Reserve, you would have the Federal Reserve become part of the Treasury and issue credit according to acts of Congress. The money supply, the interest rates, and the approved lending categories would all be set by public law, not by a clique of Wall Street zombie bankers meeting in secret, unaccountable, unelected, and all the rest. The estimate is that the essentially the nationalization of the student loan program saves $80 billion. This means $40 billion additional for Pell Grants. It means the average Pell Grant can now go from $5,350 per academic year to $6,900 over 10 years. That's too slow, too little, but better than nothing. And it can be indexed to inflation after 2011. And if you're a veteran, you get a Pell Grant and the GI Bill. We'll be back in a minute.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Hurrying on, remember, go to tarpley.net and get my books, Surviving the Cataclysm, Obama the Postmodern Coup, and Obama the Unauthorized Biography. This student loan reform bill coming out of the House, it better pass the Senate, and Barkey, you better sign it. Ending subsidies to private lenders, zombie lenders, to make student loans. Well, the fact is they weren't making them last year, last autumn into the springtime. They weren't making them. A lot of people had to drop out of college because they couldn't get the loans. So why pay them to provide spotty service when you can do it much more cheaply in a direct way? Direct federal lending. That's the way out of the depression. Revamp the entire system. Knock off the Federal Reserve. Nationalize them. Force them to do direct federal lending. Not spending, but lending, and you will get out of the depression. Also notice, in this case, the lending category is education. That's productive. That's what you want. So it's got a dirigistic approved category of lending. They're not asking for loans for derivatives or speculation or drug money laundering. They're doing it for education. So it's also got $8 billion for child care, socially necessary. $10 billion for community college renovation. That means construction work. That's stimulus. That's production. $4 billion to modernize schools. More stimulus, more production. Tangible, physical, real-world production. They also reformed the FAFSA, and if you've had to fill out the FAFSA, the free application for federal student aid, the basis of loans and grants, then you're going to be happy about that one. Now, let's look very quickly at the healthcare debate. We've now got the Baucus bill. The Baucus bill is the Obama bill. Reports from Capitol Hill are that Obama is supporting the Baucus bill in private conversations. Dear Obama bots, your betrayal is complete. You wanted single-payer Medicare for all. You didn't get it. He dropped that before he got out of the gate. Now he's dropped the government option. He's endorsing Baucus. Baucus is a monstrosity. Everybody knows it. There's a whole chorus, a hue and cry. Howard Dean doesn't like it. Ron Wyden doesn't like it. Jay Rockefeller doesn't like it. Anthony Weiner and that group in the House doesn't like it. And of course not. How could they like it? What you're going to have now is if you earn up to $66,000 a year, I think this is a family of four, you have to pay 13% of your income to a for-profit, blood-sucking, zombie private insurance company, which is deregulated, and you can't sue them. And they'll give you, yeah, they'll say no pre-existing conditions, and they'll jack the rate up into the ionosphere, into interplanetary space. And if you don't want to be part of it, you'll have to pay up to $3,800 as a penalty. And that would probably bring in $50 billion, according to one estimate. Young people will be forced to pay the private insurance companies. And in the process, of course, $500 billion will be looted and gouged out of Medicare and Medicaid. There will be taxes on health insurance plans. This is absolute nonsense. Obama lied. Obama promised in the past that he would support single-payer, Medicare for all. He lied. There are even recordings that the Republicans play, right? The Republicans attack what he said then, not what he's doing now. There was indeed a debate between O'Reilly and Rove, where O'Reilly said Obama's not nationalizing anything. He's doing everything for the private insurance companies. And, of course, Rove has to hang on to this ideological construct that this is a government takeover. It's not a government takeover in the sense of knocking the private insurance companies out. It is the fascist corporate state putting the power of the government behind the private insurance companies. That's fascism in terms of economics. Now, there's a big argument about whether this is constitutional. My view is that it is unconstitutional. How can you have an individual mandate that an individual has to buy health care from a private insurance company? You are forced to get insurance on a car, but that's part of registering the car. It's not for getting a driver's license even. It's to register a car. You cannot be coerced into buying private insurance just because you're there, right? Because you exist. Now, the way that it's likely to be structured is the following. The individual mandate will take the form of a 2.75 increase in the income tax. That's what you're going to have to pay the federal government, except if you buy private insurance, you will get a tax credit back for that if you have insurance. So that means you'll get the 2.7 that you lose to the income tax. You'll get that back on the back of the form through a tax credit if you're doing the 1040 on the back of the form. But the problem is, what qualifies as insurance, and how can they force you to spend 13% of your income on the insurance? But most important, if you take, for example, the education credit, it's any qualified education expense, tuition and fees. It doesn't say you have to go to the University of Missouri. It doesn't say you have to go to Williams College. It doesn't tell you that there's an approved government cartel of institutions that you can pay your money to and then take a tax credit on that. No matter how you cut this, if it's going to be an increase of the income tax, which is then balanced by a tax credit if you buy the insurance, and if you don't, you pay a penalty as well as paying the tax, you are still being forced into a relationship with a state-sponsored compulsory cartel of insurance companies, the goal of which is to drive down services, drive down medical care, deprive you of medical tests, But of course, to prop up the derivatives and profits of these zombie private insurance companies. So this, in my view, is unconstitutional. It goes beyond the Commerce Clause. Commerce Clause says Congress can regulate interstate commerce, commerce among and between the several states. But just by sitting here in Pennsylvania or California or wherever you are, just sitting there doesn't mean that you, individual, are part of interstate commerce. And above all, how can the government force you to buy something from a private company, even if they are a member of a state-sponsored fascist corporate state cartel? It's unconstitutional in that sense. And this is no crackpot right-wing argument. This basically says, how can the government force you to be subservient with your income to a private predatory zombie insurance company banker interest? In other words, a finance oligarch is going to get your money through the power of the federal government. That's fascism. That's a state-sponsored compulsory cartel. So I think there's a broad area here of rational, not crackpot or legal crank arguments, but perfectly rational arguments that it is unconstitutional. Now, we've heard of Jimmy Carter, right? Jimmy Carter thinks if you're against Obama, you're a racist. Nancy Pelosi thinks that if you protest, you're preparing violence. This is the age-old elitism versus populism. These people are rich elitists, and the problem of rich elitists in the era of globalization is that they hate the masses. They hate and fear the vast majority of working people, white, black, or any other kind, in the United States and around the world. We're going to have the referendum against the European Union, hopefully, in Ireland on October 2nd. Irish voters, vote down those Eurocrats and Eurogarks and get yourself out from under the European Central Bank if you can. If you're in some place like Iceland, don't join them. But now we see Carter and Pelosi expressing their class consciousness. Carter, of course, is a hypocrite. In 1970, when Carter ran for governor of Georgia, he sounded like Lester Maddox and George Wallace. He was anti-busing. He was basically pro-segregation nostalgic. So Carter telling us about race, go back and look at that 1970 Carter campaign. It's written up in Obama, the Postmodern Coup, the making of a Manchurian candidate. So we have all kinds of people getting to Obama's left. Hannity, by going to Fresno, California, and protesting for the water needs of farmers who are being destroyed by the lunatic ecological extremists and rich elitists of the Environmental Protection Agency and these other elitists. Hannity has struck a populist pose. He got to Obama's left on this issue. O'Reilly is to Obama's left by demanding a government plan. O'Reilly doing better for a government plan than Obama. Dick Morris defending Medicare against Obama, even the Republican National Committee defending them. And look, when Michelle Obama goes to the farmers market here over by the White House, she's a rich elitist. What does she buy? Tuscan kale, organic Asian pears, dandelion greens, free-range eggs. Remember, Obama is the arugula candidate, and at this market you pay $3 a pint for potatoes that you can get for 40 cents a pound at the supermarket. You get the picture. Rich elitists. Rich elitists. It's time for a populist groundswell.